nothing else he could do. But the courage that had been awakened in him was now too strong. He could not leave his friend so easily. He wavered, groping in his pocket, and then fought with himself again, and as he did so the arm crept nearer. Suddenly resolve hardened in him, and he seized a short sword that lay beside him, and kneeling he stooped low over the bodies of his companions. With what strength he had, he hewed at the crawling arm near the wrist, and the hand broke off. But at the same moment the sword splintered up to the hilt. There was a shriek, and the light vanished. In the dark there was a snarling noise. Frodo fell forward over Merry, and Merry's face felt cold. All at once, back into his mind, from which it had disappeared with the first coming of the fog, came the memory of the house down under the hill, and of Tom singing. He remembered the rhyme that Tom had taught them. In a small, desperate voice he began, "Ho, Tom Bombadil!" And with that name his voice seemed to grow strong. It had a full and lively sound, and the dark chamber echoed as if to drum and trumpet. "Ho, Tom Bombadil, Tom Bombadillo! By water, wood, and hill, by the reed and willow, by fire, sun, and moon, hearken now and hear us. Come, Tom Bombadil, for our need is near us." There was a sudden deep silence, in which Frodo could hear his heart beating. After a long, slow moment he heard plain, but far away, as if it was coming down through the ground or through thick walls, an answering voice singing,
"Oh, Tom Bombadil is a merry fellow, bright blue his jacket is, and his boots are yellow. None has ever caught him yet, for Tom he is the master. His songs are stronger songs, and his feet are faster."
There was a loud rumbling sound, as of stones rolling and falling, and suddenly light streamed in, real light, the plain light of day. A low door-like opening appeared at the end of the chamber beyond Frodo's feet, and there was Tom's head, hat, feather and all, framed against the light of the sun rising red behind him. The light fell upon the floor, and upon the faces of the three hobbits lying beside Frodo. They didn't stir, but the sickly hue had left them. They looked now as if they were only very deeply asleep. Tom stooped, removed his hat, and came into the dark chamber, singing,
"Get out, you old wight, vanish in the sunlight, shrivel like the cold mist, like the winds go wailing, out into the barren lands, far beyond the mountains, come never here again, leave your barrow empty, lost and forgotten be, darker than the darkness, where gates stand forever shut, till the world is mended."
At these words there was a cry, and part of the inner end of the chamber fell in with a crash. Then there was a long trailing shriek, fading away into an unguessable distance, and after that, silence.
"Come, friend Frodo," said Tom, "let us get out onto clean grass. You must help me bear them."
Together they carried out Merry, Pippin, and Sam. As Frodo left the barrow for the last time, he thought he saw a severed hand wriggling still, like a wounded spider, in a heap of fallen earth. Tom went back in again, and there was a sound of much thumping and stamping. When he came out, he was bearing in his arms a great load of treasure, things of gold, silver, copper, and bronze, many beads and chains and jeweled ornaments. He climbed the green barrow, and laid them all on top in the sunshine. There he stood, with his hat in his hand and the wind in his hair, and looked down upon the three hobbits that had been laid on their backs upon the grass at the west side of the mound. Raising his right hand, he said in a clear and commanding voice,
"Wake now, my merry lads, wake and hear me calling. Warm now be heart and limb, the cold stone is fallen, dark door is standing wide, dead hand is broken, night under night is flown, and the gate is open."
To Frodo's great joy the hobbits stirred, stretched their arms, rubbed their eyes, and then suddenly sprang up. They looked about in amazement, first at Frodo, and then at Tom standing large as life on the barrow top above them, and then at themselves in their thin white rags, crowned and belted with pale gold and jingling with trinkets. "What in the name of wonder?" began Merry, feeling the golden circlet that had slipped over one eye. Then he stopped, and a shadow came over his face, and he closed his eyes. "Of course, I remember," he said. "The men of Carn Dûm came on us at night, and we were worsted. Ah, the spear in my heart!" He clutched at his breast. "No, no," he said, opening his eyes. "What am I saying? I've been dreaming. Where did you get to, Frodo?" "I thought that I was lost," said Frodo. "But I don't want to speak of it. Let us think of what we are to do now. Let us go on."
"Dressed up like this, sir?" said Sam. "Where are my clothes?"
He flung his circlet, belt, and rings on the grass and looked round helplessly, as if he expected to find his cloak, jacket, and breeches and other hobbit garments lying somewhere to hand.
"You won't find your clothes again," said Tom, bounding down from the mound and laughing as he danced round them in the sunlight. One would have thought that nothing dangerous or dreadful had happened, and indeed the horror faded out of their hearts as they looked at him and saw the merry glint in his eyes.
"What do you mean?"
asked Pippin, looking at him, half puzzled and half amused.
"Why not?"
But Tom shook his head, saying,
"You've found yourselves again out of the deep water. Clothes are but little loss if you escape from drowning. Be glad, my merry friends, and let the warm sunlight heat now heart and limb. Cast off these cold rags, run naked on the grass, while Tom goes a-hunting."
He sprang away downhill, whistling and calling. Looking down after him, Frodo saw him running away southwards along the green hollow between their hill and the next, still whistling and crying,
"Hey now, come hoy now, whither do you wander? Up, down, near or far, here, there or yonder? Sharp ears, wise nose, swish tail and bumpkin, white socks, my little lad, and old fatty lumpkin."
So he sang, running fast, tossing up his hat and catching it, until he was hidden by a fold of the ground. But for some time his "Hey now, hoy now!" came floating back down the wind, which had shifted round towards the south. The air was growing very warm again. The hobbits ran about for a while on the grass, as he told them. Then they lay basking in the sun with the delight of those that have been wafted suddenly from bitter winter to a friendly clime, or of people that, after being long ill and bedridden, wake one day to find that they are unexpectedly well and the day is again full of promise. By the time that Tom returned, they were feeling strong and hungry. He reappeared, hat first, over the brow of the hill, and behind him came, in an obedient line, six ponies, their own five and one more. The last was plainly old Fatty Lumpkin. He was larger, stronger, fatter, and older than their own ponies. Merry, to whom the others belonged, had not, in fact, given them any such names, but they answered to the new names that Tom had given them for the rest of their lives. Tom called them one by one, and they climbed over the brow and stood in a line. Then Tom bowed to the hobbits.
"Here are your ponies now," he said. "They've more sense, in some ways, than you wandering hobbits have. More sense in their noses. For they sniff danger ahead, which you walk right into. And if they run to save themselves, then they run the right way. You must forgive them all, for though their hearts are faithful, to face fear of barrow wights is not what they were made for. See, here they come again, bringing all their burdens."
Merry, Sam, and Pippin now clothed themselves in spare garments from their packs, and they soon felt too hot, for they were obliged to put on some of the thicker and warmer things that they had brought against the oncoming of winter.
"Where does that other old animal, that Fatty Lumpkin, come from?" asked Frodo.
He's mine, said Tom. My four-legged friend, though I seldom ride him, and he wanders often far, free upon the hillsides. When your ponies stayed with me, they got to know my lumpkin, and they smelt him in the night, and quickly ran to meet him. I thought he'd look for them, and with his words of wisdom take all their fear away. But now, my jolly lumpkin, old Tom's going to ride. Hey, he's coming with you, just to set you on the road, so he needs a pony. For you cannot easily talk to hobbits that are riding when you're on your own legs, trying to trot beside them. The hobbits were delighted to hear this, and thanked Tom many times. But he laughed, and said that they were so good at losing themselves that he would not feel happy till he had seen them safe over the borders of his land. "I've got things to do," he said. "My making and my singing, my talking and my walking, and my watching of the country. Tom can't be always near to open doors and willow cracks. Tom has his house to mind, and Goldberry is waiting." It was still fairly early by the sun, something between 9 and 10, and the hobbits turned their minds to food. Their last meal had been lunch beside the standing stone the day before. They breakfasted now off the remainder of Tom's provisions, meant for their supper, with additions that Tom had brought with him. It was not a large meal, considering hobbits and the circumstances, but they felt much better for it. While they were eating, Tom went up to the mound and looked through the treasures. Most of these he made into a pile that glistened and sparkled on the grass. He bade them lie there, free to all finders, birds, beasts, elves or men, and all kindly creatures, for so the spell of the mound should be broken and scattered, and no wight ever come back to it. He chose for himself from the pile a brooch set with blue stones, many shaded like flax flowers or the wings of blue butterflies. He looked long at it, as if stirred by some memory, shaking his head and saying at last, "Here is a pretty toy for Tom and for his lady. Fair was she who long ago wore this on her shoulder. Goldberry shall wear it now, and we will not forget her." For each of the hobbits he chose a dagger, long, leaf-shaped and keen, of marvellous workmanship, damasked with serpent forms in red and gold. They gleamed as he drew them from their black sheaths, wrought of some strange metal, light and strong, and set with many fiery stones. Whether by some virtue in these sheaths, or because of the spell that lay on the mound, the blade seemed untouched by time, unrusted, sharp, glittering in the sun. "Old knives are long enough as swords for hobbit people," he said. "Sharp blades are good to have if shire folk go walking east, south, or far away into dark and danger." Then he told them that these blades were forged many long years ago by men of Westerness. They were foes of the Dark Lord, but they were overcome by the evil king of Carn Dûm in the land of Angmar. "Few now remember them," Tom murmured. "Yet still some go wandering, sons of forgotten kings, walking in loneliness, guarding from evil things folk that are heedless." The hobbits did not understand his words, but as he spoke they had a vision, as it were, of a great expanse of years behind them, like a vast shadowy plain over which there strode shapes of men, tall and grim with bright swords, and last came one with a star on his brow. Then the vision faded, and they were back in the sunlit world. It was time to start again. They were ready, packing their bags and lading their ponies. Their new weapons they hung on their leather belts under their jackets, feeling them very awkward and wondering if they would be of any use. Fighting had not before occurred to any of them as one of the adventures in which their flight would land them. At last they set off. They led their ponies down the hill, and then mounting they trotted quickly along the valley. They looked back and saw the top of the old mound on the hill, and from it the sunlight on the gold went up like a yellow flame. Then they turned the shoulder of the downs, and it was hidden from view. Though Frodo looked about him on every side, he saw no sign of the great stone standing like a gate. And before long they came to the northern gap and rode swiftly through, and the land fell away before them. It was a merry journey, with Tom Bombadil trotting gaily beside them, or before them on Fatty Lumpkin, who could move much faster than his girth promised. Tom sang most of the time, but it was chiefly nonsense, or else perhaps a strange language unknown to the hobbits, an ancient language whose words were mainly those of wonder and delight. They went forward steadily, but they soon saw that the road was further away than they had imagined. Even without a fog, their sleep at midday would have prevented them from reaching it until after nightfall on the day before. The dark line they had seen was not a line of trees, but a line of bushes growing on the edge of a deep dike, with a steep wall on the further side. Tom said that it had once been the boundary of a kingdom, but a very long time ago. He seemed to remember something sad about it, and wouldn't say much. They climbed down and out of the dike, and through a gap in the wall, and then Tom turned due north, for they had been bearing somewhat to the west. The land was now open and fairly level, and they quickened their pace, but the sun was already sinking low when at last they saw a line of tall trees ahead, and they knew that they had come back to the road after many unexpected adventures. They galloped their ponies over the last furlongs and halted under the long shadows of the trees. They were on the top of a sloping bank, and the road, now dim as evening drew on, wound away below them. At this point it ran nearly from southwest to northeast, and on their right it fell quickly down into a wide hollow. It was rutted and bore many signs of the recent heavy rain. There were pools and potholes full of water. They rode down the bank and looked up and down. There was nothing to be seen. "Well, here we are again at last," said Frodo. "I suppose we haven't lost more than 2 days by my shortcut through the forest, but perhaps the delay will prove useful. It may have put them off our trail." The others looked at him. The shadow of the fear of the Black Riders came suddenly over them again. Ever since they had entered the forest, they had thought chiefly of getting back to the road. Only now, when it lay beneath their feet, did they remember the danger which pursued them, and was more than likely to be lying in wait for them upon the road itself. They looked anxiously back towards the setting sun, but the road was brown and empty. "Do you think," asked Pippin hesitatingly, "do you think we may be pursued tonight?"
"No, I hope not tonight," answered Tom Bombadil, "nor perhaps the next day. But do not trust my guess, for I cannot tell for certain. Out east my knowledge fails. Tom is not master of riders from the Black Land far beyond his country." All the same, the hobbits wished he was coming with them. They felt that he would know how to deal with Black Riders, if anyone did. They would soon now be going forward into lands wholly strange to them, and beyond all but the most vague and distant legends of the Shire, and in the gathering twilight they longed for home. A deep loneliness and sense of loss was on them. They stood silent, reluctant to make the final parting, and only slowly became aware that Tom was wishing them farewell, and telling them to have good heart and to ride on till dark without halting.
"Tom will give you good advice till this day is over. After that your own luck must go with you and guide you. 4 miles along the road you'll come upon a village, Bree under Bree Hill, with doors looking westward. There you'll find an old inn that is called the Prancing Pony. Barleyman Butterbur is the worthy keeper. There you can stay the night, and afterwards the morning will speed you upon your way. Be bold, but wary. Keep up your merry hearts, and ride to meet your fortune." They begged him to come at least as far as the inn and drink once more with them, but he laughed and refused, saying, "Tom's country ends here. He will not pass the borders. Tom has his house to mind, and Goldberry is waiting."
Then he turned, tossed up his hat, leapt on Lumpkin's back, and rode up over the bank and away, singing into the dusk. The hobbits climbed up and watched him